Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, owner and lead writer behind Game Wisdom. We got a great cast for you tonight. My guest is the founder and designer for Glass Bottom Games. Please welcome Megan Fox.
Hello.
Hi, Megan. It's a pleasure to have you on again.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
For those of you listening who did not listen to our first roundtable, Megan was one of our first group panelists for that one.
Yeah, that was like 2 months ago, I think.
Yeah, December. Time is just flying, I think.
Yeah. I say, for the last 2 months, I've been in Mega Crunch doing 93-hour weeks. Yeah, a little tired. But yeah, it's productive. Game comes out this Friday, and it's looking great.
Yep. And the game that Megan's talking about is Hot Tin Roof, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that later in the cast.
Yeah.
All right. So to get things started with, Megan, since this is your first solo guest appearance on the Perceptive Podcast, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and Glass Bottom Games?
Yeah, sure. So, like I said, my name is Megan Fox. I've been in the industry for 8 years. Might actually be past 8 years now. It's somewhere around 8 years. Started with a company called Eidolon, went on to a company called NetDevil, working on LEGO Universe. While I was there, the company then became Gazillion, and then Playwell Studios, and then got shuttered after LEGO Universe's launch. And then I went on to found Glass Bottom Games. We made Jones on Fire first, which was a critical success, financial failure, and then from there went on to make Hot Tin Roof, which is what I'm working on now.
Cool. And I'm looking at your projects. You also started two other games. It looks like you did the prototype for the Savage Garden. And what was that about? It looks like this was a prototype concept you guys were working on.
Yeah. So Savage Garden was the... Was that the first one? I believe that was the first one I made after LEGO Universe got shuttered. And it was... it was basically a Metroidvania. And it was what I thought of at the time as a scaled-down version of the concept I actually wanted to make. I was like, oh, yeah, sure, we could do this. And we've got 3 months before IGF. Sure, let's put together a prototype. And I'm sure it'll be done in good fashion. It was just kind of terrible and was way larger scope than we could have ever made. So what we submitted to IGF was pretty gnarly and obviously didn't place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we ended up binning that since it was too big to make. We went from that to working on a game called Asha Runs. Actually, wait, what was the actual sequence? Somewhere in there was Asha, which was Savage Garden. And then also mixed in there was the Gravitas concept, the Kickstarter we ran that failed. And there was also a game in there called a game about knitting. And then at some point, Asha became Asha Runs, which was a stripped-down mobile version of the concept, which was an infinite runner. I began working on the tech for that. I think that was after I had to let Dennis Dryden, my artist, go. I think that was just me. And then I want to say at that point was when we had the Blaze Jam game jam, and I went there, and I had the code base from Asha Runs. So I thought, sure, I'll just make a funny runner. And that's where I made the fireman and the cat, and that became Jones on Fire.
Cool. Now, talking about the formation of Glass Bottom Games and have you gotten to this point, one question I like to ask a lot of developers who made the move to the indie market is, what has been your experience going from working at a major studio to forming your own development house?
I'm sorry, could you restate the question? I'm not sure I'm understanding totally.
I was just saying, since you moved from going from a major developer, like a AA, AAA studio, to owning your own indie studio.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I don't know. There's there are enough differences that the comparison almost falls apart from being useful. Being indie, one of the primary things is you've got to run your own business, and that's a skill set you just don't learn in AAA at all, obviously, because that's not your job. A lot of these skills that you learn in AAA don't transfer across, but at the same time, having AAA in the background is extremely useful. It's kind of like asking if someone's fine art degree served them well in moving on to a life as a contract artist, career artist, et cetera. It's one of those gaps. But yeah, there's a lot of changes. It's a kind of an open question. If you've got specific questions, I can answer them.
Let me see. I know we've spoken to a lot of guests on the podcast, a lot of people who have made that jump. One thing that I hear a lot as a major pro, of course, is the creative freedom. And one of the major cons is the fact that you're more, I guess, compartmentalized compared to a AAA studio where you have 30, 40-member teams working on a project. for your studio, I know you're a very small team. Have there been like any like unique issues or unique positives aspects of being an indie as opposed to when you were working as a major studio?
Well, the most obvious one is just the creative control. At LEGO Universe, I don't want to say that AAA doesn't give you creative control, because sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a lot of jobs that don't. Like, there's the story of the artist at EA working on the Madden games. He did nothing but noses for 17 years. Ooh. And you get those kinds of things. That doesn't say all of AAA is like that. But the big difference is the creative freedom, being able to work on effectively whatever I want. But that isn't to say I can work on literally whatever I want, since I need to work on things that, you know, can actually be enjoyed by players at the end.
Okay. Now, another big question I want to ask you, Megan, regarding the indie market or going from AAA to an indie market, is in terms of like the actual market itself, consumers that you're dealing with, has there been any noticeable or important differences between making a game for the AAA or AA market versus trying to make one in the indie space?
Well, the single biggest is probably that, so in AAA, you can compete with sequels, and you can compete with games and genres. You can compete with genre titles. By that, I mean you can make a shooter, a corridor shooter, a competitor to, drawing a blank, Call of Duty. Yeah. You can make a, whatever we're going to call the Assassin's Creed games, a game about running around on rooftops, whatever that genre is, you can make a game like that and compete. And the way you compete in those genres is with polish or graphical quality or on setting or theming. Sometimes that's enough. Yeah. That kind of thing doesn't work in indie. Our games are not such where we can realistically release a corridor shooter, for instance, and expect it to do well. Because if we compete in those genres, the gamer at the other end is looking at, well, I could play this low-rent looking corridor shooter, or I could play Advanced Warfare. I wonder which I'm going to play. There's just not much market there. So you have to compete in either the genres that AAA doesn't do, so you're competing with other indies, one of those being side-scrollers, or you need to go for niches, kind of the spaces between genres. You can also distinguish yourself graphically, aesthetically, using aesthetics that, for instance, are Bakshin art that AAA doesn't use. But if you just make a corridor shooter about grim, dark AAA army dudes, you can't succeed. That's one of the big ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, Megan. And I want to go back to what you just said a second ago regarding not being able to compete with the AAA-defined genres. So first-person shooters, massive multiplayer co-op games or competitive games, stuff like that. And one of the things that I've been talking to a few other indie developers about lately is the indie market, specifically with indies trying to branch out and go beyond just making a $5 to $10 game. We're seeing a lot of indie and AA developers pushing things further with games priced at $30. Recently, Off-World Train Company is going to be released at $36. So my question for you, Megan, is as someone who has experience in both spaces, do you think we will get to a point where indie developers can release a game at a premium price? I'm talking $50, $60 and try to compete directly with the AAA market.
So that's where you kind of torture the definition of indie.
Okay.
The idea with indie or independent is you are not taking external investment. You are burning your own money, your studio's money, whatever. And that isn't say those games are small. Something like Double Fine, for instance. They are independent. They're an independent studio. They don't, well, I mean, they do sometimes work with publishers. But they don't have big external investors, et cetera. But that doesn't work for that size of budget. Whenever you're talking about $60 games, you're talking about competing with games that have conservatively $60,000 budget or $60 million budgets at this point. There isn't a studio alive that can do that. Well, there's like maybe one that I know of, and I think they're the ones that just did Destiny, and even they had to take external investment because they decided they'd rather make a $200 million game. That can't really happen. What independent can do is they can scale up and take over what used to be middle tier, and that's the $30 tier.
Yeah.
And that's already happening. You're seeing more and more games of that. You're also seeing exceptions like Chris Roberts, for instance.
Star Citizen?
Yeah, Star Citizen. That is technically an independent game, though you could also adequately argue that crowdfunding on that scale isn't quite the same thing. And it seems likely they've taken external investment at some point in there. So that's kind of the only way that tier could ever scale up to AAA levels of polish and budget and price tags. But scaling up to $20, $30, even sometimes $40, if you look at the studio, they made a game called Hard Reset. I can't remember the name of the developers.
I'm drawing a blank on that, too.
Yeah, but still, they're an example of someone that did make a corridor shooter that didn't really distinguish itself in any way other than being, you know, a decent corridor shooter. And they released it, I think, a $30 or $40 price, and it did, I hear, okay. They're still around. Is it Heavy Machine? Machine Games, maybe?
I just looked up. I think they're called Flying Wild Hog. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's it, that's it. And for all I know, it actually didn't do all that well, and now they're doing contracting, but who knows?
Yep. And I think you made a really good point about that, Megan, regarding just the amount of money that goes into making a $50, $60 game. I mean, we can look at Grand Theft Auto V. I think they had like a $300 million budget. And this also takes us into the debate about game devaluation, because this has been another major issue. As you said, a lot of indie developers are moving up into the quote-unquote middle tier, so $20, $30 for a full-release game. And one of the things that we're seeing is a lot of consumers are pushing back against that due to just the sheer volume of games coming out. When I spoke with John Schaefer of Conifer Games, he talked about the issues he's having with pricing his game at $30, and people saying, you know, why are you pricing this so much? I want to buy this at $15 or $10. And
which game is this?
At the Gates.
At the Gates. Let me, while you're talking, I can look it up so I can actually talk about it intelligently.
And what he said was he would love to release a game at, you know, $10, but literally he cannot profit from it at that point. When you're making like a grand, you know, turn-based strategy game or a game that you're spending years on, you can't just spend 2-3 years on a game and then release at $5, $10 and recoup that investment. And this is one of the things that I've heard from a lot of developers who are worried about game devaluation, is the fact that if they're trying to, as you said, trying to move up to middle tier, the $30, $40 mark, but the game consumer's only expecting, you know, they want $5, $10. That may cause some conflicts in terms of scope and game development.
So, yeah, this is one of my pet peeves. The idea of game devaluation in PC is a bit of a red herring. The discussion starts because mobile games have devalued, therefore PC games are devaluing. And then they point wildly at bundles and go, but look, bundles! That presumes that the people that are buying those games in bundles were previously people that would have bought the game at full price, when that is very, very, very unlikely. What bundling does is it targets a wider market than your initial release targeted, and so on and so forth. Now, it is probable that the Steam discount culture has to some degree disincentivized some people from buying the games. But that's not terribly likely. None of the data that I've ever pulled up has ever supported that. What does happen, or what has happened, is that Steam has had a lot more developers on it lately.
Yeah.
Which means their existing visibility systems are now a lot more taxed. I don't want to say overburdened, because most people, if you mark properly, are still able to do pretty well. But it's definitely... There are a finite number of ad slots, and you get those based on performance. And if there are twice as many games, then it stands to reason you get half as much visibility, or, you know, whatever. That results in lower sales, but not the bundling.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't buy it. So I'm looking at the Gates. At the Gates is a game that looks similar to Paradox Software. What Paradox Software does, they're the Avernum guys.
Yeah.
Though they haven't made Avernum, they're actually making something else now. But I always remember them as the Avernum guys.
They've been doing like Crusader Kings and Europa Universalis, I think, are their two big claims to fame at the moment.
Okay. Still, they're basically doing the same thing. And what they're doing is they're targeting a niche market. And that niche market will support a certain price.
Yeah.
If you want to... So I'm looking at the Gates. And it looks like a fine strategy game. But the problem he's going to run into is this is not how a strategy game needs to look if he wants to target the $30 range. And if you're trying to make a game that has to be $30 to be made, and it looks like this... what you're basically doing is trying to will a market into being that doesn't exist. I mean, I get that he wants to make this game and he wants to charge that much because he wants to spend this much time on it. Mm-hmm. But those constraints target a market that, according to him and what he's finding, doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't work. The Avertum software guys, Jeff Vogel, it's just guy, really, Jeff Vogel and his wife, mm-hmm. They have been working in the space for, I want to say, decades at this point. I believe it's almost 20 years.
Yeah, I think it was like it was going on 20 years when I interviewed him like a few weeks, or actually a few months ago at this point.
It feels like, but still, they have established a market of exactly the kind of people they need. And even they can't charge more than $20. Mm-hmm. So if John Schaefer wants to make a game like this and charge $30, that's great, but mm-hmm. I don't know if the market exists. Yeah. And saying that that market doesn't exist because of devaluation is this massive red herring. Mm. That's the thing that a lot of people do whenever they are trying to target a market that doesn't exist, or they have a commercial failure, or they have a critical failure. You know, with one of those things, they don't want to look at the problem one way, so they frame it another way. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would call that argument.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought up a few things ago, Megan, regarding the bundling misconception, because I wrote a post about that a few months ago when the studio behind Attack on Titan, Puppy Games, they were talking about the issues they had with bundling and how it was causing people not to buy their games at full price. And I had to call BS on that, just like you just said. And it's because of the fact that people who are buying these bundles, they're not, you know, your main audience. These, as you said, these are people who were never going to buy your game or very unlikely to buy your game in the first place. It's the same, I think, issue that we see with people crying that game piracy was going to ruin everything. Because a lot of the people who pirate games are the men and women who had no interest in the title to begin with. Or they were only interested in, you know, $2-3.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's necessarily that they're only there's also the misconception that bundlers are bad people and that they don't care about the games, and you know that there are large, less than flattering pictures painted of them. Mm-hmm. All it really means is that they're someone that's not interested in enough in your game to pay $15. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're at the $5 tier or whatever. Yeah. The bundles go down. All that means is maybe you're talking about an FPS gamer that occasionally plays strategy games and you're making strategy games. So yeah, for sure, I kind of like those. I'll check it out in a bundle. Mm-hmm. And that is the kind of person you're targeting with bundles. It's not this growing mass of people that refuse to pay for games. It's just your niche has this much and this goes beyond that niche, and that's how you do bundle pricing. It's just how it works. Yeah. And this existed in brick and mortar too. We called it, you know, bargain bins.
Yeah. Now, regarding game pricing, as we said, with developers trying to push into the middle tier, I want to get your thoughts, Megan, on what Introversion Software has done with Prison Architect and how they explicitly priced the game at, I think, $30 or $35 when it was first released to specifically counter people just trying to play a game that was nowhere near done. And that game has been going down in price over the last few years. I know they've recently announced that the game will be done at some point in 2015, but I know a lot of people who bought week one or month one at $30, $35, while there are still people complaining, why are you charging so much, etc., etc.
Let me frame a response to that. It's an interesting problem. Or not a problem, it's an interesting change. Okay. Excellent. Sorry, I haven't thought about Prison Architect in a couple of years. It's been a while. Then that's kind of telling that it's an early access game that's been around long enough and prominent long enough that I now have to recontextualize it. But even though it's still totally selling well, I just haven't. Yeah, so it's an interesting approach, and it's interesting. It does address the problem of people getting your game when it's cheap and then scaling up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it would work for everything. Yeah. It's kind of like early access on Steam. It's interesting and it works for certain genres or types or games in general. It wouldn't work for others. Like if I put Hot Tin Roof on early access, that would be a really bad idea. Mm-hmm. If I charged $30 for Hot Tin Roof before it was actually done, it would not work for me. So I would say that it's interesting and that it worked for Prison Architect, and you're probably going to see, well, I think you've already seen a lot of other games try the same thing and fail miserably. Mm-hmm. Because after you've done it once, There was another movement like this, the Pay What You Want movement for bundling.
Yeah.
That died miserably because after the spectacle wore off, people went, oh, this is kind of stupid. I'm not going to pay more than what I want for this. And then the only one that's still around for that is Humble Bundle. And the only reason Humble Bundle is able to do it is because they have such a deep mailing list that they can like contact everyone in the world and get a significant portion of them to spend a dollar. Anyone else that tries it, not so much.
Yeah.
Prison Architect has the visibility to pull off the price high pay low. If you start smaller than that and you price high and pay low, you just don't have sales. So, yeah.
Okay. My last question then regarding game pricing and issues like that before we move on. Give me 1 second. I just lost it. Let me grab a drink. Maybe that will help.
Indeed. By the way, for our listeners, I am drinking grape off-brand Kool-Aid. Grape off-brand Kool-Aid. It's what's in your mouth.
I just have regular water. It's what we all need. So my last question then for you, Megan, regarding game pricing and the debate over devaluing or not, is when we talk about like crowdfunding in general, as you just said regarding Prison Architect and how they went for the buy high or price high then sell low, what do you think about games that are going for they're selling really low and then will raise the price over time? Stuff like Besiege, Kerbal Space Program, Minecraft, those types of games.
That is a more, I don't want to say effective because Prison Architect is perfectly effective, but it's a more likely not to be flooded and then become pointless kind of sales tactic. Pricing low, then increasing over time, you're incentivizing early purchase. So there's a reason to share it. There's a reason to buy in early. Players are going to look at it and go, oh, okay. And it can create kind of a locus of awareness. If you price high and sell low, a price high and go down from there, that only works if you have the visibility to begin with to actually sell a game for $30 and have people trust that the game you're selling for $30 won't suck. And that's a very, very tiny fragment of the market. Whereas the fragment of the market that could exploit a, hey, this game is really cool, and here's a video of it, and you can play that for like $2, and then it's going to become $15 later. You should buy it now. That's a much easier sell, and will work for a lot more people.
Yeah, I agree with you, Megan, on that. And we are seeing more and more developers, I think, go that route. But I think going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding certain games working for early access and those that can't, I think there is a very specific set of games that work with this buying low or buying at the lowest level and then letting the game grow. As we've seen, I think a lot of sandbox-oriented titles work best in this because you get more toys as the game goes on, ergo the price goes up. But it obviously wouldn't work for a story-based game. It would be impossible to say, buy the story at $5, we'll add, you know, more cutscenes, you know, 2 years from now. Get the story now and then, you know, what happens later.
Yeah.
All right, moving on then from game pricing, I wanted to touch on Kickstarter and crowdfunding with you, Megan, because as we were talking about earlier, your project Gravitas was a game that you went to Kickstarter for, and unfortunately it didn't meet its funding. And one of the things I do like to talk to developers about is not only their thoughts on Kickstarters, but their general strategy or philosophy when going into it. We've spoken to a lot of developers who've had successful Kickstarters, but we've also had a chance to talk to a few who unfortunately didn't make it. So for you, Megan, with Gravitas, when you were pitching the concept to Kickstarter, were there any things that you felt you did, you know, extremely well and other things that may have not worked out for you that could have led to the project not getting funded?
The largest thing that I did wrong, well, I had to go do it because I was running out of money, but the thing I did wrong was went to Kickstarter too early. Our presentation just wasn't as polished as it would have been if I'd waited a little longer. And that's the at the time it was still possible to reasonably fund something that was a little less polished. That's become harder and harder over the years.
Yeah,
I think I got in right at the end. I'd be very surprised if you could still do that today. Well, I don't know. I guess I only asked for 20, so you probably still do that. But point is, I would have gone much later if I could have. Kickstarter, the idea is you kickstart projects with it, but in practical terms, you kind of need to have a project done at least to a certain extent before you go. And if you don't, you're going to struggle.
Yeah.
And you can see that now with games like, was it Strife? No, Strafe. Strafe is one of them. And the one with the space guy? Crap, what is it? Just referenced this. Star Mazer. No, Star Mazer.
Okay.
Star Mazer and Strafe are up there right now, and both of them have really, 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 really polished presentations, and they're both asking for, I mean, it's a lot. It's around 150 or 100, mm-hmm. and I think they'll make it, but they're just going to barely make it. And the amount of marketing that Star Mazer has put into making mm-hmm. that point, I mean, they've shown at multiple shows. They have a really big team. It's you need to have a really, really polished presentation. And if you do, then you get something like Moon Chronicles, where mm-hmm. Moon Chronicles asked for, I think it was, did they ask for 40 and then they made 100, or did they ask for 80 and then they made 200? Mm-hmm. But they way overfunded. Mm-hmm. That's more the Kickstarter structure you need to follow today if you want to do it. And what they did is they had a game where they had enough of it polished and looking final that they could show the video of it and mm-hmm. get people behind it, but they still had, you know, work left to do.
Yeah. And I think the polish is definitely a critical aspect today. I know I was looking at the Kickstarter for Gravitas. You launched this, I think, in 2012. And that was right around, like, the boom of the Kickstarter, when Double Fine blew things up, FTL. And as you said, Megan, these days, people want more than just, you know, a hope and a prayer. They want to see that you've actually put something together, that there's some kind of meat there before they start pledging money. And I think it is getting to the point where it's getting harder and harder for someone to just say, hey, I have an idea, but, you know, I need $5,000 to get it done. Would you help fund me with that? Now it's, I have an idea, I have to put together, let me build a prototype, or let me get a concept trailer up first, and then see if you're interested.
Even a concept trailer won't get you very far, unless your name is, mm-hmm. you know, Jonathan Blow or something.
Yeah. And as we've seen, there's been definitely a decline in terms of how much people are pledging to Kickstarter in 2014 compared to 2012 and 2013. And part of it has been, I think, a lot of people have grown, I wouldn't say distrusting Kickstarter, but they're a little bit more wary of quote-unquote passion projects versus those where you have a team with a laser-focused game plan of we're going to do this, this, and this. And this is what we're scheduling for, this is what we're budgeting for.
I don't want to say that there's been a decline in backing, because the amount of money mm-hmm. backed actually went up mm-hmm. year to year. What happened is there were, I think, twice to three times as many projects, something like that. I remember reading stats. So it isn't clear if we're reaching a point where people are getting tired of backing, mm-hmm. or if the problem is just that there are enough Kickstarters and people are reaching that, you know, I rather than do that one project at 80, I think maybe I should do these six projects I'm interested in at 10 mm-hmm. kind of thing. I feel like that might be more the case, which is why the presentation matters so much. Mm-hmm. Now there's a lot more competition on Kickstarter, so you've got to market the crap out of your game. So the people are thinking, oh man, this is the one game I'm going to back this year, because holy crap, this is the game for me.
Yeah, I think the culminating point of that is that you can't just one day decide to go on Kickstarter. You can't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to put my project on Kickstarter. You need to actually build a Kickstarter campaign to have any real chance. When I spoke with Red Hook Games behind the Darkest Dungeon, they explicitly said, we spent 6 months looking at Kickstarter, building a trailer, and getting everything ready before we decided to go on the platform. And that worked out amazingly well. And as you said, Megan, presentation is really key these days, and they just absolutely nailed it, I think, in my opinion.
Sorry, say that again?
I was saying that the presentation aspect is so key that Red Hook Games, after they spent 6 months researching and building the campaign, they really just nailed it in terms of presentation, and they were well rewarded for it.
I would very much agree. They also had a really good Razer focus, mm-hmm. and they created a game that right now there is a zeitgeist. I don't want to say the zombie thing is finally passed. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say survival horror, but there's something toward that grim angle, which mm-hmm. is kind of related to survival horror. Kind of that space is really hot right now, mm-hmm. mostly because it lends itself well to permadeath games and to roguelike games, and to it shows really well in YouTube, because it gets the people that are casting, you know, screaming and yelling at the game, and that's kind of what their listeners want or viewers want. So it works really well with that. And because of that, I mean, it just exploded. They obviously put a lot of marketing effort into it outside of those channels, but mm-hmm. I would say that it's one of those right game, right time sort of moments.
Yeah.
And they marketed the crap out of it. They did really well.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I agree that, like, roguelikes and, like, I would say maybe, I wouldn't say gothic, but games that are really designed to push you have been growing really popular. We have FTL, as you just said, Darkest Dungeon, even games like Dark Souls, and more games designed around that kind of replayability. As you just said, Megan, is a really popular option for YouTubers and Let's Plays, because you can really show off a game. There's a lot of excitement around these 20, 30-minute chunks of, you know, one mission or one playthrough. It's something that I've been doing more with the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, is I've been running Darkest Dungeon runs almost like every night. And as you said, it works really well because someone can watch a single quest and it's almost like watching a 30, 40-minute TV show. And it's something that you can't really do with a narrative focus or an 80-hour RPG.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we move on from Kickstarter, I want to ask you one other question that I like to ask a lot of developers, and that's regarding Kickstarter's viability. This is another popular debate we've heard from people. It's probably getting a little bit more heated now that, as we've said, it's becoming more and more important to make a dedicated project. So for you, Megan, do you think Kickstarter will remain viable, or you think that things may have to change or shift in order for it to still remain a popular option for game development?
Well, the first question is what you mean by viable. We are already to a point. We're already to a point where it's not a project starting device. Mm-hmm. It just isn't. It's a device that you can use to get money whenever your project is in a presentable state, often towards the end of development, not the beginning. So it's more like kick finisher than Kickstarter. That itself probably makes it non-viable for, I don't know, half the people that were originally looking at Kickstarter a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as being a marketing tool, as far as being a finishing funds tool, that kind of thing, that thing that, okay, so every game starts and does its community building, and then it does a green light, and then it does a Kickstarter at the end, and then it releases it, and then it goes early access. That, in terms of that flow, it'll stay viable. It's not going anywhere. You're probably going to see Kickstarters become a critical component of most, I don't want to say larger budget indies, because that includes people like Double Fine and Chris Roberts, and I don't know where the high end is. But in terms of say, Mike Bithell and Volume, that level of game, you're probably going to see Kickstarter become a critical component of three quarters through the development, halfway through the development. It's going to hit somewhere in there.
Okay. And I just remembered a really good point I wanted to bring up regarding Kickstarter. As we just said, and as you just mentioned, Megan, regarding having Kickstarters be more of a finish or a way to end a project, I would say it would be an interesting counterexample that would have been the adventure game from Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick, who they made, of course, the original Adventure of Monkey Island, Maniac Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, they started completely with Kickstarter. They are trying to get the project off the ground. But I think what helped their success is the star factor of these guys.
Well, yeah, Kickstarter's always going to be an avenue to get money if you're a star. And if you, for Thimbleweed Park, if you are the original developers of Monkey Island and Maniac Mansion and a bunch of other ones, they got the artist, was it the artist or the sound guy? They got one of the primaries from Zach McCracken, the Alien Mindbenders, which was one of my favorites as a kid. Mm-hmm. It was really janky. It had a lot of problems, but there was a point at which you used a stale loaf of French bread either as a weapon. I think it was as a weapon. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. But yeah, when you've got star power like that, yeah, you can do just fine.
Yeah. And as a quick aside, someone who enjoys eating French bread, when that thing goes like a week old, you could really use it as a weapon. That thing just, it becomes almost like steel or like a small baseball bat.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe that's where, I think they may have had some French bread while they were designing the game. Maybe that's how that solution came about.
There was also a puzzle in which I believe you put stale French bread through it. Was it a meat grinder to get breadcrumbs? And then you used those with a pigeon or a bird?
Nice.
There was the whole sequence where I want to say that you got the French bread like in the first 5 minutes from your kitchen, and then you didn't use it until the plane crashed halfway through the game. It was one of those kind of like the King's Quest games, every King's Quest game had something you got in the first 5 minutes that if you didn't use it right 5 hours from then, mm-hmm. you lost the game. Mm-hmm. And King's Quest, Roberta Roberts, they liked puzzles, or she liked puzzles, I guess, where you could misuse the item in the first 5 minutes. Classic mm-hmm. example is King's Quest V. They give you a pie. At the very beginning, you need to get a bird to leave, I think it's a rabbit alone, mm-hmm. and you can either throw a boot at it or you can give a pie to it. If you give the pie to it, you have lost the game, and you're just going to play the game for 5 hours until you realize that.
I'm glad I didn't get to the Adventure Genre back then, because that would have driven me nuts.
Oh, and that's not even the worst one. That's just the one I remember. And the stupidest thing is the whole thing was for a sight gag. You get to that point, and the reason you need the pie is because you're in the mountains fighting an abominable snowman, and you need to throw the pie at its face so it falls off the mountain. Mm. You have a ton of other items in your inventory that you could probably do something with, but no, either you do the sight gag or you lose.
Yeah, we could probably spend another 3 minutes going over all the adventure game foibles there. All right, I just remember one of the questions I wanted to bring up while we were talking about crowdfunding. I think this will sort of be a great ending to talking about Kickstarter. And I want to get your thoughts, Megan, on early access. We've been talking more about Kickstarter as a way to end a project. I wanted to get your opinion on how early access has been developing and growing. We've heard a lot of people talk about how great it is. There's those who feel that it needs to be changed. And it's definitely become an interesting tactic. I've spoken to developers like Zach Barth, who he said that once he swore off early access and how it's changed his mind with what he's doing with Infinite Factory. So what are your opinions on?
Could you ask the question one more time?
What are your opinions on the early access model and what's been going on with that as a way to fund a game while it's being developed at the same time?
Well, I don't know. It's a complicated kind of question. There are upsides and downsides, and like I said earlier, it really, really depends on the genre, the type of game, mm-hmm. etc. For games where you finish, where you have a core... roguelikes are the obvious example, but where you have some kind of core where the game is conceivably complete, but, you know, there's like one iteration of the content, so it gets really boring really fast. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of games are a great fit with early access, because the way that those games get fun is with two things. You add content over time, and you need players constantly thrashing your content to find all the bugs and all of the balance issues and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It works really well with early access, and that's why a lot of the successful early access games are those that have that core concept plus a bunch of gravy on the top things. Mm-hmm. 7 Days to Die is obviously another example. Yeah. The Forest. I can't even list all of them. There's hundreds of them at this point.
Rust, The Long Dark, Project Zomboid, and there's the whole survivalist genre has really just exploded over the last five mm-hmm. years.
I would not want to be making a survival game right now. The competition is so bad.
Yeah.
So bad. Yeah. But that's the kind of game that works really well with early access. And for that kind of game, early access will, I think, remain viable. The risk you run into is the other kind of game that works well with early access potentially is multiplayer. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a multiplayer game that is changing drastically as it goes.
Yeah.
You need to have some kind of core game. Multiplayer works because the core game is based on its players, therefore it changes constantly. It's the same game isn't the same twice. Survival works because the core is, et cetera. You can't do it with single player games because it's not like they change much. But still, the problem you run into is if you fuck that up, mm-hmm. you break your release day. Because early access games don't really have a release day. Mm-hmm. They just have the day that you go on early access, which mm-hmm. counts as your release day. And then almost all of them just peter out. You're going to get a swell of sales, and then it's going to go down. Mm-hmm. And then theoretically, you can run another Steam release, and they do promote you on Steam release, so you can get another release bump. But it's not going to be anywhere near as strong as if you'd done it straight out of the gates, and you've got to be really careful with how you manage your community throughout that time. You've got to make sure that you have compelling updates every week or every 2 weeks or every month. Mm. And you have to have something really big saved up for release day so that people actually care about you again and cover you. Mm-hmm. Because normally release day, you power it on the back of, articles and YouTubers, and they all explode out and they say, oh my God, this game is amazing and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And it creates this big swell of popularity. And that's what creates your launch day bump. if your game is old news by the time it's launch day because it's been on the market for 6 months and it's the same game it has always been, you're not going to get that. You're going to get the little swell of popularity that comes strictly from Steam's systems promoting you like they do all games.
Yeah.
Like, you're guaranteed a million views, I think it is. And that's it. And then you're going to fall off and poof, and you're going to make about, I don't know, 30,000 launch week, and that'll be it.
Yeah.
And then you'll be back to baseline. So yeah, it works, but it doesn't. You got to be really careful.
And that's a really good point in terms of managing the community, building the game up. That is a topic we explore in a upcoming podcast when I spoke with Seth Sivak, and we basically talk about how it's not so much about capturing lightning in a bottle with your game anymore. It's about trying to create this perfect storm of brand, marketing, and game so that people are constantly talking about your game, as you just said, Megan, keeping with the community, keeping with the updates, so that your game never disappears. Like we mentioned Prison Architect a few minutes ago, they've been doing monthly updates for over 2 years now, and it's really served them well because people are still talking about the game.
And they were able to actually create compelling updates, which is really surprising. You wouldn't think something like Prison Architect could go in that many directions, but they've managed to, even though they don't have Nuclear Throne, for instance, they can throw in cool weapons and cool powers, and they can. It's all very interesting. You wouldn't think Prison Architect could do that. I mean, like, if you were to play a Civ game and the Civ game were dribbled out month by month, I really don't think, and there's a new cultural victory that you can get. I don't think that would sell the same way, but they've managed it. But it's all because they've been super, super good with how they've promoted things.
Exactly. And I think this goes back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding the roguelike survival genre and how it's about having that very core foundation that's fun, that's great, and then you're just adding on top of that. You're basically adding the icing to the cake. So if the game is already great to begin with, and you're going to say, okay, you like this, now we're going to add all this new content. It's like, oh my God, I loved it before. I'm going to love it even more now. All right. And I think with that, I mean, this has definitely been a great podcast so far, Megan. I think this could be one of those times we could just sit here and talk about the industry for the next two to 3 hours. But I know you got a game coming out this week, and I think it's time we move on to talk about that. So, Hot Tin Roof, as we said at the beginning, will be released at the time this podcast goes up, which will be on Friday. The game should hopefully be out. So, for those who haven't heard much about it, can you tell us what is Hot Tin Roof?
So, Hot Tin Roof is basically Metroid meets L.A. Noire with an Inspector Gadget gun. It's got the Metroidvania platforming kind of gameplay, plus noir stylings, clue finding. There's a lot of adventure gameplay in terms of dialogue and interact with NPCs and running down case leads and that kind of thing. Your power system is the revolver. The revolver cannot be used to kill anything. It's purely for maneuverability and for puzzle solving. So instead of getting, you know, exploding rounds or whatever, you get stuff like knockback rounds that let you fly through the air, or grapple rounds, or bubble rounds, or stuff for breaking things, that kind of thing. And it lasts about, normally here I would say 4 to 6 hours, but we had a playtest session this Sunday where the player had been playing for 8 hours, had still not beaten it, and before our tester said anything, begged to come back later so she could finish the game. So I actually don't know how long it is. Probably longer than 4 to 6 hours.
Okay. In terms of like game complexity and challenge, are you aiming for like a casual audience or more of like a core or fans of the old school Metroidvania style games?
That's a tricky question. We're aiming mostly for fans of the old school Metroidvania genre because towards the end of the game especially, a lot of the platforming challenges get, you know, kind of hard. We didn't pull many punches.
Okay.
The camera can get a little frustrating because it's got this cool 2D, 3D mechanic where it's a 2D side-scroller set in a 3D world, and you can actually turn corners and your side-scrolling plane moves with you, and you can go back at T-intersections, and you can maneuver through a 3D world using side-scrolling controls, and that complicates things a little bit. There's a lot there that makes it a kind of, you know, difficult game, but we wanted that because, I don't know, I like that kind of game, and it's fun. Without that, it would have been reduced to kind of just adventure gate mechanics, which is a bunch of key finding. The keys look like clues, or whatever. It's just a bunch of key finding. And that kind of gameplay is fun, too, but we didn't want that to be all there was. So we tried to strike this really delicate balance between the two.
Okay. In terms of like the actual Metroidvania design or the exploration, what was like the general design philosophy around building the Metroidvania elements into Hot Tin Roof?
Number one was that we would never gate you using... So there's also a system of clues in the game, and that's where the adventure game mechanic comes in, and you need to follow proper investigative procedure and get search warrants, and there's that kind of thing. But we wanted to make it so that the hardcore Metroidvania player that just wanted to do the Metroidvania thing and didn't care about anything else, they needed to be able to beat the game. Mm-hmm. And they can. They can't get a... The ending they get is exactly the ending you would expect for a... investigator that ignores procedure, busts down doors, and runs people up on false charges. Mm-hmm. But they do get an ending, and it's not even a bad ending. It's just a different ending. It's called Loose Cannon. and it actually ends with a riff on, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That's the last one of the last lines you say in the game. I really like that playthrough. but yeah, so there's that was one of the things that we wanted to get right with Metroidvania, the integration of the Metroidvania. But as far as regular design, it's mostly Metroidvania is all about lock and key. But instead of the keys being, you know, red key, blue key, etc., it's abilities.
Yeah.
And bad Metroidvanias tend to give you abilities that literally serve no purpose other than as a key. We didn't want to do that. So all of our abilities serve actual purposes. I don't want to list them out, so sorry, listeners, you'll have to play the game, but I'll list out the first couple so that you get an idea. The bubble rounds are a detective tool. We initially had, if you play Shadow Complex, it was basically the scanning visor for Metroid, but they didn't call it that. But the scanning visor. We initially had the scanning visor, and that's how you figured out clues and found things. But it was kind of boring, and it didn't use the revolver mechanic very well, so we replaced it with bubble rounds. Bubble rounds are things you can shoot to reveal hidden things, and that's useful throughout the entire game. It is how you investigate, and there are many clues you can only get that way, and yada, yada, yada. But it's more practically used to do things like reveal switches or reveal platforms you couldn't see before. There's actually kind of a brutal thing at the end where if the player doesn't realize that, bad things happen. The other one you got was thud rounds. Thud rounds are for breaking things. So they're used for breaking down barriers, for opening boxes, that kind of thing. There's even some motors that you can smash, which are kind of like switches, but they only switch one way because they're motors. And once they're broken, they're kind of broken. And then there's grapple rounds, which allow you to grapple around, but they also let you to pull open doors and pull down swingy door things. I think there's something else. Mostly they're used for climbing, and basically that kind of thing. So yes, all of those can be used to gate, like we can put a swing door in front of you unless you have the grapple rounds, or you can't get past it because you can't pull it open. Or we can put a switch that, you know, unless you reveal the switch, you can't get through. But it's not as bad as, like, Shadow Complex. As I remember, they had two explosive types, or they had some stuff that it just didn't serve a purpose other than, yeah, this is pretty much the same thing as you just got, but now you can blow up the red things instead of the blue things. The Metroid Zero Mission? Is it Zero? No, it wasn't Zero Mission. It was Fusion. Yeah. Even Fusion had some of that crap. What is this for? Oh, it's to be used in that one corner of the game where I actually use it and then I never use it again.
Yeah.
Fusion was just a terrible Metroid game, which is really disappointing. And they even turned Samus into a weak person, and she was ordered around by the computer. Ugh, I did not like that game. But yeah, that's the thing. We're trying to make sure that all of the abilities are interesting, not just lock and key, even though they also serve a lock and key purpose. Those are kind of the two main things we focused on with Metroidvania.
And as a complete tangent, I bet you didn't like Metroid Other M either. That was just...
I have never even played it because I watched some of the cutscenes and saw what Team Ninja decided to turn Samus into, and I saw the part where she cries, and no, I'm not going anywhere near that game. Yeah. That is not a Metroid game.
Yeah, I would love to talk more about, but that's an hour-long conversation easily.
However, I did like the mechanic where they had the side-scrolling, but they would go into 3D sometimes, and it would be really cool if we saw another game that wasn't complete shit do that.
Now, getting back to the Metroidvania philosophy, you made a really good point, Megan, regarding having skills that actually impact the game rather than just being a simple key. And I think the game like Strider, I remember, had a problem with that. Like, you unlock the red weapon that specifically only opens red doors.
Oh, God, I played Strider recently. I got about 3/4 of the way through, and it was finally, they gave me, like, the red ability, which served no freaking purpose other than to open the red door. It's like, come on. Which is too bad, because the mechanics were solid, the combat was fun, and some of the abilities didn't suck. They just didn't,
Yeah. Now, I think you are sometimes forced to have those game mechanics, like, excuse me, like when a game unlocks double jumping, for instance. That would be a game mechanic built into the level design, but then it becomes used throughout the game. You can use it to get over enemies, you can use it to maneuver easily. And I think it becomes a lot harder when you're trying to build mechanics rather than just building keys to open doors, as you said.
Well, it does, but if you're going to make a Metroidvania, mm-hmm. So Metroidvania is not an easy genre. Mm-hmm. Everyone looks at it and they think, oh, gosh, I mean, that's nothing. You just put some abilities in and you're done. No, to make a good Metroidvania, you mm-hmm. need to be able to conceive of interesting abilities that are interesting in and of themselves. Shoot, I need to pull up a name and I can't think of it. Sony recently previewed an indie Metroidvania pixel art, which has a sci-fi bent, and there's a scene in it with like a robot face with pipes going into the wall. Mm. Oh man, I can't think of the name. Okay, listeners, just put Sony Metroidvania PS4 into Google and I'm pretty sure it'll come up. Just look for the pixel art. Axiom Verge, there it is. I think it's called Axiom Verge.
Okay.
They actually came up with a lot of really compelling. I played an early access copy. All of their mechanics, a lot of them, focus around interesting shot patterns. And they come up with some really clever ways of using shot patterns so that they're useful for enemies, but they're also useful for puzzle solving. And they do a really clever job. And that's an example of a good Metroidvania. They mm-hmm. have a world and they have the mechanic that they want to theme the world around. And they come up with other mechanics based in that structure that work really well together. But a lot of Metroidvania people just go, okay, well, we're going to do the double jump, and we're going to do the longer whip, and then we're going to do the thingy that lets you see the hidden. And they just pick a bunch of random abilities that don't have much synergy, and because of that, they only serve a purpose of finding that one door in the corner that you need to, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And since we got on the subject of Metroidvania, I want to get your thoughts on one thing, Megan. I wrote a post a few months ago talking specifically about Metroidvania design. And in that post, I felt that Metroidvania really isn't a genre in the sense that you would call like a first-person shooter or a 2D platformer, but I felt it was more, it's a specific form of game design where you're using new mechanics and systems as a form of progression. So I just want to get your thoughts. This may turn into a little quick debate, but do you consider Metroidvania as, you know, that classification a genre or more of mechanics and systems for a specific game?
The answer to both those questions is yes. Metroidvania exists as a genre thanks to Metroid and Castlevania. I mean, mm-hmm. that's where the name comes from. That, if you make just a game that is like Metroid and Castlevania, you have made a Metroidvania. That's great. They're simple games. They're very straightforward. They're very indie compatible. The mechanics that go into Metroidvania, though, and the lock and key design, mm-hmm. which is tends to be hub and spoke, mm-hmm. That style of design happens to work elsewhere. Something like Batman Arkham Asylum mm-hmm. or Batman Arkham City or Batman Arkham Theme Park or got whatever the hell there are to at this point.
Yeah.
That is an example of Metroidvania used as a mechanic. Mm-hmm. Mechanically, they have a lot in common with Metroidvanias. Well, Arkham Asylum did. I did not like City. I really hope the next one by Rocksteady doesn't is better. Mm-hmm. Anyways, side tangent. So you can use it mechanically, and at that point you've created, a lot of people actually call Batman a Metroidvania, and that's not a bad label. It's kind of a simplification, but mm-hmm. That's what it is. But they've layered a lot of mechanics on. So yes, you can use it in either case. If you boil those mechanics down to their basest form, however, you have targeted the Metroidvania genre, which I'd say overall is probably one of the most flooded and poorly mm-hmm. understood and... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably has the single, in terms of all the genres put together, Metroidvanias is probably vying with first-person shooters as largest percentage of the genre, which is complete shit games.
Yeah, and as we were just saying a few minutes ago, a lot of people who go into Metroidvania just make key mechanics. You're not making growth in terms of what the player is doing. You're just saying, you unlock, you know, ice boots, so now you can walk on ice surfaces. But now there's only like 3 sections of the game that have ice surfaces. He's like, oh, what's the big deal?
I did want to go back. I can actually think of one example of an indie game that uses Metroidvania as a mechanic as opposed to the genre. Mm-hmm. It'll Do is an example.
Okay.
It'll Do, you look at it and you think it's a Metroidvania or a Zelda game. And Zelda and Metroidvania, they're super, super close and they're mm-hmm. not quite the same thing, but the main difference is top-down versus side-scrolling. Mm-hmm. Zelda 2 is a Metroidvania even though it's a Zelda game.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so It'll Do, you'd look at it and you'd think it's a Metroidvania game. It's actually Sudoku. Or not Sudoku. The block pushing puzzle.
Pushmo. There's an actual name for it. I can't think of it.
Not Towers of Hanoi. Azkaban. Azkaban? Azkaban? Crap. Anyways, listeners will know what I'm talking about. It's the one level in NetHack. Every game has that block pushing puzzle where it's top down. That's what It'll Do is. And it's a really clever one. But what they've done is they've created a suite of mechanics that happen to interact with block pushing puzzles. So that is an example of an indie game that uses Metroidvania as a mechanic style instead of a genre style. But yeah, sorry, continue.
And yeah, and as you said, Metroidvania really became huge with the indie space. I mean, I'm thinking of like games like Aquaria, Abyss Odyssey, and a lot more that go forward, because when it works, as we said with like Metroid, Castlevania, and those types of games, it can be a really amazing experience. And it's one that's not heavily reliant on graphics. It's more about the game design mechanics. But again, it's very easy to screw that up with not proper balance and not actually rewarding the player with new abilities. Okay, going back to Hot Tin Roof then, one thing that I wanted to touch on, as you just said a few minutes ago, we're going to having different endings and the play length. So can you play through the game in like different ways? Like, are there different solutions around the puzzles or the situations?
One of the advantages of creating, I don't want to call it a true Metroidvania, but a not bad Metroidvania, and I think I've made a not bad, well, we have made, Michael Nielsen, by the way, is my co-designer. He's also the level designer. Most of the levels you played, he put together. Like when you get to High Table, the giant factory, he did all of that. I did most of the design of the dump, though he then went over and made it better, and we kind of worked together on Old World. I put the structure of Old World down, and he filled it with puzzles. So everyone knows. If you make a good Metroidvania, and like I said, hopefully I've made a good one, everything has a designed solution, but that doesn't mean it's the only solution. And I've tried to create puzzles. The final area is probably the best example of this in Hot Tin Roof. I created a lot of puzzles that you reuse a lot of mechanics, or well, Michael did, and then I worked them over a little bit. But it doesn't necessarily mean you've got to beat them in one way. Like, there's one room that I designed to use what are called knockback rounds, which I'm not going to tell you what they do, but you can guess. And then I found out when I was going through it, I could actually get through it with grapple rounds. I could get through it without either of them if I was really careful. And was there another way to get through? I think it was just grapple and knockback. But still, there were two distinct paths. A lot of players sit down at our game and they decide grapples are the best thing and they use grapples for everything. A lot of players then get to knockback and say, you know what, screw these. I like grapples better. Others like the knockbacks. Torch rounds can be used for a lot more than is initially clear, but I don't know. There is a type of obstruction that torches can be used. You can see torches in the first 5 minutes, even though they're upgrade number 3, so I'm not too concerned about that. There are obstructions designed to be burned away by them, but you can also just avoid those obstructions if you're a good player. So it's, yeah.
Okay. Now, as you mentioned with the rounds being your tools for the game, does the player have like any like ammo limitations, or they can only use an item X amount of times, or they need to pick something else up? Or is it once it's unlocked, you know, it's yours forever, go nuts with it?
Yeah, we initially tried the limited ammo, and we found out it was just obnoxious. So what we did is, no, there are no ammo limitations. I don't know if a limited ammo ever actually made it into the engine. I want to say we had it planned, but never did it and decided it wasn't very good. There were a lot of problems with it. Mostly, we didn't want to create situations where you would get into a corner and then run out of the core ammo type that you needed to get back out of that corner. Since to get around those cases, either we would have to never design those corner cases, or we would have to design a ammo refill mechanic that could be found literally everywhere. And the combination of one or both of those things really limited the problem space of puzzles that we could present to the player. So no, well, once you unlock an ammo type, you can use it as much as you want. The limitation is your revolver can only hold four rounds at a time. So a lot of the gameplay is in figuring out what load you happen to run around with that works well for you.
Can you reload your gun at any time? Or
yep.
Oh, okay.
It does not pause the game, though. So if you're on a conveyor belt and you're reloading your revolver, hopefully you're fast.
Okay. Now, a few more questions then for you, Megan, and then I'll let you go for today. In terms of the art style for Hot Tin Roof, how did your team approach developing the aesthetic for the game? Because as you said, it's about a 2D character, 2D side-scroller that can navigate around like a 3D environment or 3D space.
Oh, the most honest answer I can give is carefully. Mm-hmm. It was a really big problem. We fought back and forth with me and Fulmer were initially pushing for a really, really simplified style, which mm-hmm. is what you can see in the Kickstarter trailer, a lot of flat colors. Mm-hmm. The artists wanted a rich style, and they were more fond of rounded corners and rounded edges. And there was even a version of Emma pitched early on that had rounded corners and little comic. She looked like, you know, the Worms games?
Yeah.
The modern ones, how the 3D versions have hands and such. Mm-hmm. I guess the games themselves, I don't think there was Worms 3D, but most of them are still 2D. But still, when you look at the 3D versions, there was a version of Emma that looked like one of them, mm-hmm. and that was not going to work. So yeah, there was a lot of back and forth to figure out the style that we had ended up with. In terms of making that work with the side-scrolling stuff, mm-hmm. one of the things we found really early on is that we could not do the game like we're doing and also use realistic visuals. The reason for that is a lot of the scenes actually terminate into a black void. There's just nothing over there. Mm-hmm. And if we tried to put something over there, the cost of filling all of those voids with content that looked good but you couldn't get anywhere near and also got out of the way whenever the camera rotated around, it would have been prohibitive to possibly impossible. So we hid those cases where we could. In general, we avoided them, but we designed an aesthetic and a general style of game that, sure, there's a void around it, and you're okay with that because my character is a box, so maybe I'm not too concerned about other lacks of realism in this game.
Okay. Now, we could probably talk a lot more about the design of Hot Tin Roof, but I know with the game coming out, or should be out by the time people read this or listen to it, I think we can probably start to wrap things up. So, I guess a few last questions in for you, Megan. One is, in terms of what's next for Glass Bottom Games, do you see your team continuing to add content to Hot Tin Roof? Or is this a game that, as we've been talking about over the course of the cast, is this a game that once it's out, you know, it's a complete experience, it's done, you're not going to add new levels or stuff like that?
It depends how the game does. I would like to, in the Kickstarter, we had some stretch goals for extra content, and there were a couple of other things. I would like to address some of those, mm-hmm. but they're not going to be in the shift version because we designed the game to not have those things. Mm-hmm. But I would like to add a couple of pieces of post-release free content. I would call them DLC, but it's not like they're going to be, you know, buy separate DLC. It'll just be you patch the game one day and you get an announcement that says, hey, we put new content in, and hooray. Mm-hmm. It would all be in this form of additional side quest stuff. It won't be anything that affects the main plot. There's nothing missing from the game. It's just, I would like to add some of that stuff back in because in my documents, there is an entire write-up for Chinatown, what Chinatown is and who the Mandarin is. And there's a lot of stuff there. There's even an entire ammo type that we cut out from the game because nothing in the content that we had designed for the main game really used it all that well, and we didn't just want to throw it in without some context to it, so we cut it out and would like to add it back in with post-release content. But again, all of this only works if the game is, you know, a success financially when it launches. Mm-hmm. So I can't answer that question until after Friday. So by the time people are listening to this, it'll be Friday. Mm-hmm. By the next Monday, I might have an answer to that. We'll see.
All right. And I guess the other question that I have to ask then, Megan, is do you guys have an idea for what your next project will be after Hot Tin Roof, or is that still up in the air at the moment?
We know exactly what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Not going to talk about it.
Oh, okay.
The only thing we're going to... I'm not even going to say the name. No.
Oh. Okay.
No. You'll know it when you see it.
Awesome. All right, Megan. Definitely a great point to leave our listeners, you know, hanging on. But yeah, this has been a great cast. I would love to, like, dedicate, like, a full cast with you regarding, like, Metroidvania design, because that's one of my genres that I love. I mean, I still enjoy playing Symphony of the Night. And it's a genre that really has a lot of very subtle nuances that makes it work, or as we've said, that distinguishes a great one from one that just plain sucks.
Mm-hmm.
So, my final question then for you, Megan, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans listening?
appreciate your support on Friday. When you're listening to this, please go to the Steam store, search for Hot Tin Roof, and it'll actually pop up with the Hot Tin Roof, the cat that wore the fedora. It's the longest, I think, Steam... No, we're not the longest. A blatant disregard for gravity beat us. Damn it. But still, we're one of the longest titles in on Steam. Please, check us out on Steam. If you have a favorite YouTuber, please maybe poke them and ask them, hey, can you do this game? Because we need all the promotional support we can help. Because, yeah. We're just a small developer, and we appreciate people like you, because without you, we cannot do what we do. We appreciate every single eyeball and ear we get, so thank you so much for listening to this.
Awesome. And I just remember my question from earlier, just a very quick one. Will Hot Tin Roof be available on any other platforms besides Steam, or will it be Steam exclusive?
It will be on Steam, Good Old Games, and Humble. It is already on Humble and Steam. Good Old Games, we've been cleared. I've actually had a contract waiting for approval. It's sitting in front of me right now. But I don't think it's going to be able to be on there by Friday. I want to say this at the 24th, so next Tuesday, something like that. Yeah. But yeah, it'll be on Steam, Good Old Games, and Humble at first. In the future, we'd like to bring it to consoles, but that, again, all depends on stuff that we can't predict right now.
All right. Do you see it going on to mobile at all?
Yes, but after consoles, most likely.
Awesome. All right. I think with that, we can wrap things up. Megan, again, it was a pleasure talking to you on the podcast. I hope to have you back on again after Hot Tin Roof is out. And yeah, we definitely need to have a Metroidvania-themed podcast at some point.
Sure. I'd love it.
Awesome. So with that said, we're going to end things here for the Perceptive Podcast. For those of you listening, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to submit a guest piece or be a future guest on the podcast, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And we are still running our monthly Patreon campaign, our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure monthly funding for the site. You can find that information under the Patreon banner on the front page. And if you enjoy what we're doing and like to see us grow it, please take a look, and any amount would help. And also make sure to check out the Game Wisdom Twitch channel, which I do live streaming of games while talking about them, usually around 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time most nights. Maybe I'll do an episode of Hot Tin Roof at some point. And that will, of course, be put onto the Game Wisdom YouTube page. So, thanks again for listening. Have a great rest of the week. Make sure to check out Hot Tin Roof, and we'll talk to you next time. Take care, everybody.
Bye.